Our final argument of the day is Jones against Astrue. Ms. Dye.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. I'm Sandra Dye. I'm here for the plaintiff today. This case involves a Social Security disability appeal. The administrative law judge's decision should be overturned for three reasons. The primary reason is the issue of credibility. The judge made an erroneous credibility finding based on an misinterpretation of the record and a misinterpretation of the claimant's daily activities. As a result of the credibility finding, the judge made an erroneous residual functional capacity assessment, and as a result, tendered a faulty hypothetical to the vocational expert. This produced jobs, which the ALJ relied upon when denying the claim. Concerning the issue of credibility, the ALJ determined that credibility was faulty, or credibility was not entirely credible, based in part due to a gap in the medical treatment. She cited a gap in treatment from August of 2005 to March 2007 with Dr. Joseph. However, it was raised that there was no gap in treatment. First, the client had seen Dr. Joseph in 2006. The district court acknowledged this and said it was harmless error. However, more importantly, the claimant had gone to see a different doctor due to a change of insurance during this supposed gap period. This was Dr. Belit and other doctors in the same clinic. During this supposed gap period where the claimant had not been treated, she had been to this clinic 17 times. 12 of these times were for her complaints of low back pain and carpal tunnel pain, the impairments that she states are disabling. Now, this is the treatment provided at the clinic included pain management. She had ongoing prescription for narcotic pain medication, including OxyContin and Vicodin, and these are significant medications causing significant side effects. Also, she did undergo two significant tests. She had an additional MRI in 2006. Now, this MRI differed from the 2003 MRI that the judge cites in the decision. The MRI showed an annular tear at L3-4, and this could be what caused the claimant's pain. This MRI, again, is not addressed in the judge's decision whatsoever. Additionally, there was an EMG conducted in 2006. This, too, was positive for carpal tunnel syndrome, another one of claimant's alleged disabling impairments. This does not produce harmless error. When the ALJ makes a credibility finding, she's determining whether or not this person's complaints are valid. If the judge finds the complaints of pain and the other symptoms would produce a disabling condition and are credible, the judge has no choice but to approve the case. However, here, the judge found the claimant to be not entirely credible, in part because of this objective medical treatment and the gap in the record. She also looked to the claimant's daily activities. Now, her daily activities were very minimal, and the judge relied only on the daily activities that supported her finding that she could perform sedentary work. She relied on the fact that she could lift 10 pounds. However, the claimant testified that when she did lift 10-pound bag of potatoes, she had to lie down the rest of the day. This isn't in the decision. She testified that she can use a computer for various things. The claimant testified she only uses the computer to check her bank balance, which takes all of 2 minutes a day. There are several instances of this nature in the decision. So when relying on a misinterpretation of daily activities that do not suggest the ability to perform an 8-hour workday, 5 days a week, the ALJ did not decide correctly in determining that she was not entirely credible. Furthermore, when she decided she was not entirely credible, the ALJ used similar language to that was chastised by this court's recent Parker decision. It's that boilerplate language that the claimant is not entirely credible. However, she doesn't discuss what parts are credible, what parts aren't credible. She only discusses it generally. So we don't know what her position was. She does not connect the dots for this court. We don't know what her thought process was. It appears that she may not even have seen these records. There's nowhere in the decision that anything from Exhibit 4F, which is in the record, was cited. There's no indication that Dr. Belit's records were cited. The updated MRI is not noted. She's using MRIs from, in large part, before her alleged onset date. So not only does this affect the credibility, but then in turn the ALJ used this to determine her residual functional capacity. Now, there is no residual functional capacity in the record other than that from the DDS physicians. The DDS physicians, too, made their determination that this client could perform light work before they had reviewed anything from 2006 or 2007. Both opinions are from 2005. So we don't have a current record. So the judge indicates that she was giving the client the benefit of the doubt, but she's not crediting all of her symptoms. She's not she doesn't suggest that or acknowledge that the client said that she had 3 to 4 bad days per month and that she has pain that sometimes rises to the level of labor pain. Now, this client had had 6 children. She understands what labor pain is. The client had reported similar symptoms to her physician, so it's not as if this came up first at the hearing. There is no explanation for her discounting these complaints. So we don't know where the judge is at. Again, this is not harmless error because the client testified to symptoms that would have precluded work activity on a full-time, sustainable, and reliable basis. Again, the residual functional capacity the judge tendered to the hypothetical or to the vocational expert in a hypothetical allowed for jobs. The judge did not include any manipulative restrictions in her hypothetical or her residual functional capacity, despite the fact that this client had carpal tunnel syndrome established by EMG and that she wore wrist splints to address the issue. The residual functional capacity is simply to sedentary work with simple routine tasks. She did not address the issue of the dizziness and drowsiness and nausea caused by side effects of her narcotic pain medication. And these are common side effects. These aren't anything unique or out of the ordinary, not addressed in the decision. The decision has less than 2 pages of substantive discussion. The commissioner has argued that we are nitpicking the record and trying to find errors where there really are harmless errors only. I think that ignoring 41 pages of medical evidence during the relevant period of time and calling it a gap and ignoring the MRI that shows a change in her condition from the prior MRI and a change in the condition from the time that Social Security's doctors had reviewed the case is significant. Ignoring an EMG test, which is a nerve conduction test that definitively establishes through testing that she had carpal tunnel syndrome, is significant. Overall, the credibility finding, therefore, is not based on substantial evidence. Therefore, the rest of the decision is tainted. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dye. Mr. Carlson.
May it please the Court, Counsel, Assistant Regional Counsel Patrick Carlson for the appellee, the Commissioner of Social Security. Your Honors, in this case, Ms. Jones makes a tremendous challenge to the ALJ's credibility determination, in large part because the ALJ misstated the time and length of Ms. Jones' treatment with Dr. Joseph. However, that misstatement was neither the sole nor the most important factor in the ALJ's RFC determination or the ALJ's credibility determination.
Is the ALJ's what determination?
Regional functional capacity determination.
You could use real words rather than
acronyms.
Disability speak.
Yes, Your Honor. The ALJ both determined Ms. Jones' residual functional capacity, that is, what work-like abilities she could do, and her credibility, how much her statements about her degree of impairment could be and should be believed. In assessing her functional capacity, the ALJ relied first and foremost on the medical evidence in the record. And Ms. Jones does admit that the only medical opinion evidence in the record is that of the state agency physicians who determined that she could perform light-level work. However, the ALJ discussed the treatment notes of her treating orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Carr, who tested her and saw her on a number of occasions and found that she had full strength and reflexes and called her condition benign in 2003 and very benign in 2004. Furthermore, he indicated that when seeing her, she made no pain presentation. Essentially, Dr. Carr, her treating orthopedic surgeon, did not find her to have a particularly problematic condition. In addition, the ALJ did note a number of notes provided by her treating general practitioner, Dr. Joseph, who made no notations of any particular problematic areas that she had that would preclude her from working in the economy. And so there was substantial evidence that would support the ALJ's RFC determination. However, the ALJ did not rely upon the medical evidence alone. The ALJ also considered Ms. Jones' statements about the the degree of her impairment. And in many situations, he encompassed in his functional capacity, her functional capacity assessment, some of the statements Ms. Jones made. For instance, if the ALJ had adopted the finding that Ms. Jones could perform light work, she could have lifted up to 20 pounds. Ms. Jones testified that she could only lift up to 10 pounds, and the ALJ reduced her functional capacity accordingly to sedentary work. In addition, Ms. Jones stated that she took heavy medication and that it made her lose concentration, sometimes be dizzy, and the ALJ reduced her functional capacity to a limitation that she performed simple and routine tasks. However, Ms. Jones' testimony went further. She said, I can sit for an hour, but then I have to lie down. And then by the end of her testimony, she said, I lie down most of the day, and it's necessary. Her husband testified that she lies down most of the day. The ALJ found that this degree of impairment that she testified to was not credible. And so she did not incorporate that into her functional capacity finding. She did not, however, base that determination solely upon a determination that Ms. Jones had not seen Dr. Joseph in 2006. She considered a number of factors. First, she compared Ms. Jones' statements with the objective medical evidence, the record. In addition, the ALJ, which we discussed already. In addition, the ALJ discussed Ms. Jones' course of treatment, which was relatively mild. She was treated with medication. She was treated with physical therapy. Dr. Carr considered the possibility of types of surgeries and recommended against it. He said it's not warranted now, perhaps in a couple of years, perhaps if your situation becomes intolerable, the necessary implication being that her condition was tolerable now. And furthermore, the ALJ compared Ms. Jones' statements with her stated daily activities. And while Ms. Jones has stated that she does these things at a very light level, what she has not admitted this morning is that once she stopped working, she obtained an associate's degree, which is not an insignificant achievement. So she clearly is able of doing more than simply being bedridden.
Counsel, did you factor in how long it took her to get that degree?
Yes, but yes, and she has testified that she did take a longer period of time, although her statement has to be parsed a little bit because she was initially going to college while she was working full time. She started working towards her degree in January of 2002, and she worked full time as an accounts payable supervisor in 2002, and she worked until November of 2003 in same position. So some of her college credits were necessarily part time. She then completed over the next few years her degree, but even that is inconsistent with her statements of being entirely bedridden, plus doing some household chores. So there is substantial evidence supporting the ALJ's credibility determination. Moreover, it's important to look at what the ALJ did not address. To the extent that the 2006 medical evidence is significant, you have to look at the entirety of the 2006 medical evidence. For instance, Dr. Lee, the neurologist, who Dr. Belit referred her to in February of 2006, looked at her 2006 MRI and said, this degree of impairment is not consistent with her claimed level of pain. So the 2006 evidence itself is not particularly troublesome. In addition, Dr. Belit himself on two occasions noted that Ms. Jones reported that her medications helped her pain. So Ms. Jones does not identify a reversible error in the ALJ's misstatement about the 2006 treatment. Accordingly, the ALJ presented the vocational expert with a hypothetical question relating to an individual with the background of Ms. Jones and the impairments he found to be credible. The ALJ identified a significant number of jobs available in the Wisconsin economy for such an individual, and that substantial evidence supports the ALJ's determination that she could perform work in the economy. The ALJ went a step further and asked the vocational expert if she was required to wear wrist braces, would there still be jobs available? And the vocational expert said, yes, fewer jobs, but there would still be jobs she could perform. Your Honor, substantial evidence supports all aspects of the ALJ's findings in this matter, and we would ask this court affirm the district court's determination affirming the ALJ's finding that Ms. Jones is not disabled. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further,
yes.
Ms. Dye?
Yes,
it
thank
looks
you.
Like it.
To address first the attainment of the associate's degree, the plaintiff did testify that, first of all, the school provided her with a special chair that she was able to use for her class. Nobody else in the class had this chair. It was designed differently, and it was more comfortable for her. Secondly, she sat in the back of the room, so she was able to get up and move around and move out of the room. She had an arrangement with all of her professors that would do this. This is not the type of accommodation that was discussed with the vocational expert as far as any of these employers allowing her to sit in a special chair or leave whenever she needed to. In fact, the judge had presented a traditional hypothetical to the vocational expert as far as sitting for 6 hours a day and standing for 2 hours a day and walking 2 hours a day, not an at-will or volitional sit-stand option that would allow her the same mobility as did her schooling. Secondly, it did take her 4 years to attain a two-year degree. 2 years of this degree was done before she even became disabled. Counsel suggests that her course of treatment was mild. She had over 100 visits of physical therapy. She had 3 epidural injections, and she was on strong narcotic pain medication. The pain medication helped but did not take the pain away, and she testified to this fact. Now, Dr. Risk had advised the claimant that there was a considerable risk to surgery, and it was therefore, again, put on a hiatus until a later date when the pain is intolerable. However, there is no intolerability standard. You know, one can consider intolerability to the point where they can no longer stand it. So the commissioner uses this as a basis, but one does not have to have intolerable pain to be disabled. To address the wrist braces, the ALJ posed this to the vocational expert if a client was wearing a wrist brace. But this doesn't mean that she doesn't have an underlying problem that would further limit her ability to work. That's just that you're wearing an apparatus, and the apparatus may indeed slow you down, not that you have an underlying medical condition that would cause difficulty working. That wasn't addressed. There are no manipulative limitations noted in the residual functional capacity. Had the judge properly addressed the manipulative limitations, it may be far greater than anything that she even discussed informally with the vocational expert. As far as the claimant's testimony concerning her limitations, the judge did not effectively address issues such as sitting down for an hour, then needing to lie down. Rather, the judge looks at her ability to sit for an hour and then assumes she can walk around for a few minutes and sit again for the rest of the day. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until next week.